Hello again, students of the Bible, and welcome back to Lesson 7 of the Bible Correspondence Course. We've been going through a series called The Law and the Christian. We'll have at least a couple of lessons to go after this one. But it's an interesting study because it develops a thorough and understanding, I think, of the Old Testament law, how it might apply to a Christian's life, how Jesus looked at the law, how Paul looked at the law, and how that law might be applied as we live our life. There's a widespread belief among many people that Jesus came to do away with the law. The Jews, they believe, had labored under the burdensome law, but Jesus came to offer grace. They think that something that Jesus specifically told them not to think. They think he came to destroy the law. We learn that far from coming to destroy the law, Jesus came to fulfill it. He said that neither dot nor comma would fail from the law as long as heaven and earth should last. Well, now the question is, where do these other ideas come from? Do they come from the teachings of Jesus? In this lesson, we're particularly concerned about Jesus and the law. And we're going to go through some very specific statements of his and show the way he taught about the law so we can understand his attitude toward it. The lesson starts with Matthew 5, verses 17 through 48. Be sure you've got your Bible open and your notes in front of you. Question number one is easy enough. It's basically, what does Jesus' opening statement in this section tell you about his intent in the words that will follow? In other words, the Sermon on the Mount is going to follow all this with all of the explanations and expositions that Jesus will be giving. Okay, what is his overall intent, then, in the words that will follow? Well, he opens it up by saying, don't make a mistake on this. Don't think I am come to destroy or the law or the prophets. I'm not come to destroy them, but to fulfill them. And he means by that to fulfill them, simply to obey them, to keep them, to fill them up, to teach them, to believe them. Jesus' belief in and teaching of the law will become very plain as we make our way through the Sermon on the Mount. Number two, is it possible for any part of the written law to pass away while sun, moon, and earth are still here? Well, Jesus said, until heaven and earth pass, one jot nor one tittle shall in any wise pass from the law till everything has come to pass. No, it is not possible for it to pass. We covered that adequately in the previous lesson. Question number three, did Jesus feel that the standards of judgment of the Pharisees were adequate? Well, it becomes plain if you've read through the entire assignment of this section, you'll see that no, he did not think they were adequate, that he would look at what had been said of old time, and then he would explain further. And the explanations that Jesus was giving were very different from those of the Pharisees and very different from what the people had been used to hearing from the Pharisees. And this is one of the reasons why it was necessary when Jesus started out for him to say, don't think I'm come to destroy the law. I'm not, but I'm going to teach it in a way that may be new to you. Question number four, are there greater and lesser commandments? Well, Jesus said in verse 19, whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. So it's plain enough that Jesus saw that there were commandments that were lesser and there were commandments that were greater. And one of the things that I might pause for a moment and make comment on, there's not a thing in the world wrong with using common sense when you're reading what Jesus says. You're going to see very shortly that if you try to take a literal approach to what Jesus said, you're going to get in trouble very quickly. On the other hand, if you just take a common sense approach to it and say, what is Jesus trying to say here and how should I understand it, it will not be that difficult for you. But surely, common sense tells you that there are some commandments that are more serious than others, even within the Ten Commandments. I know that if you break one, you're guilty of all. But all that is simply saying is that if you break a law, you're guilty of sin, you're worthy of death, and it doesn't make any difference beyond that. But the truth is, doesn't common sense tell you that there is a difference in importance between committing murder, actually taking a knife and cutting somebody's throat with it, or lying to somebody to try to save your job or get out of trouble or because of some weakness that you might have? I mean, sin is sin, I know. But common sense tells you that there are greater and lesser commandments. Number five, did Jesus approve of the breaking of even the least commandment? Well, no, of course not. That was the point that he made when he stepped out in this in the first place. Now, Jesus intends to render some judgments relative to the law. And we've already talked about this question of judgments and the rendering of judgments and how it's absolutely necessary to come to judgments about how the law might be kept. Jesus is going to do this in the Sermon on the Mount. I don't think very many people, when they read the Sermon on the Mount or preach from it, really realize that what they are reading is a rabbi teaching about the law and teaching the law. How is the law to be obeyed? He isn't teaching something really all that new in that sense. He's done what rabbis have done before him, to sit down and say, here's what the law says, here's how you keep it. Now, preparatory to rendering the judgments that Jesus is going to make, he makes it clear that he has no intention of destroying or otherwise doing away with the law. He's not even going to weaken it. In fact, the demands Jesus makes relative to the law are greater than those of his predecessors. Number 6, Jesus addresses the commandment, thou shalt not kill. Which verses include his judgments and teachings relative to this commandment? Take a moment to look at it and review it. It actually begins in verse 21 and continues all the way through verse 26. Everything in this section is an exposition of the statement that Jesus makes about the law, thou shalt not kill. Verse 21, you have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. Okay? I say unto you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council, but whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. Now what Jesus is here telling us is that at the very root of murder is hatred and anger, unjustifiable anger, anger that goes beyond any realm of common sense. And he is telling us that if you're harboring that kind of anger toward a brother, you are in danger. The commandment could easily be broken by you. Now, as he continues to say, whoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. Whoever shall say, you fool, shall be in danger of the hell fire. Now, what this is talking about is the face-to-face insult. We're not talking about the fact that if you actually come to the judgment as a result of evaluating somebody's work, that the man is a fool, you are fully justified in concluding that he is a fool, and you don't have to apologize for that. But when you walk up to him, in his presence, he's standing 2 feet away from you, and you say, you're a fool, you're inviting retaliation, you're inviting violence, you may retaliate yourself with violence, and the result of that could be, might very well be, murder. And so Jesus, as he sits down to teach the law, teaches a person right off the bat that if you're going to look at the commandment and say, well, I haven't killed him yet, so I must be innocent, you are making a very serious mistake in your judgments relative to the law. Question number 7. Was Jesus' judgment relative to the commandment more or less lenient than what had gone before? Well, maybe lenient might be a little misleading in a way, but it's actually less lenient. It's a strict commandment. He's trying to tell you that you are in getting yourself in trouble when you take the first steps that ultimately lead to this sin. The very beginning moment that you actually allow that hatred to fester, you're on your way toward the violation of the commandment. Number 8. What instructions does Jesus offer to head off a possible violation of the commandment? Well, it's really pretty simple. He says, for example, if you have gone to the altar to offer your gift and you get there and you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift at the altar, go be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your offering. Now, what does all this mean? What it means is this, is that when you are aware that your brother has something against you, when you are aware that there is or you have something against your brother and there is a hatred there that could fester into something much more serious, it is absolutely urgent that you resolve it. And it should not be put off. It shouldn't be something delayed until next week or delayed until after the feast or delayed until some other time. It's something that should be dealt with and dealt with now. The illustration that Jesus gives of having your gift at the altar suggests also that this hatred toward your brother, this attitude that is you're allowing to fester, is going to interfere with your worship of God and that your offering will not even be accepted. So the instructions are, urgently resolve these differences and these angers. Don't let them get down inside of you and fester to the point to where they spiritually lead you to commit murder. Question number 9. Under which commandment do Jesus' teachings about adversarial relationships fall? Well, you'll find the beginning in verse 25, and it is still in that section that deals with the commandment that thou shalt not kill, or thou shalt not do no murder. Agree with your adversary quickly while you are in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver you to the judge, and the judge deliver you to the officer, and you be cast into prison. Verily I say unto you, you shall by no means come out thence until you have paid the uttermost farthing. In other words, don't depend on God to pull your chestnuts out of the fire. If you proceeded in anger too far down a road in an adversarial relationship and you wind up going to court, don't come to God expecting him to bail you out of this thing. Because what God expects you to do is to resolve these things as early as you possibly can. Good common sense advice is settle out of court. Settle early. Don't get into this situation in the first place. Do what's right. Find out what the person wants. Give them, within reason, what they're asking for. Try to resolve your differences. Now, once again, there's not a thing in the world wrong with using common sense as you read through the things that Jesus is telling you. The fundamental point in it is what? Well, it is simply to agree with your adversary as early as you possibly can so that you don't wind up getting these things out of control and wind up getting taken to court, losing your house, losing your car, losing your livelihood, and maybe even, if things get clean out of hand, losing your life. Question number 10. Was Jesus' teaching on, quote, thou shalt not commit adultery, end quote, more or less lenient than what had gone before? Well, it was less lenient. He's tightening up the screws on everybody as far as how they are supposed to live their life. And again, it's the same fundamental principles at work here that was at work in the one on thou shalt not kill. Don't take the first steps. For the fantasy about a woman is the first step along the way toward a relationship that might sometime come to pass with the woman. You should take that as an early warning sign that something's not right here and that you need to repent of it, you need to go to God about it, and you need to not do that anymore. So that's a simple one. It is not less lenient than what had come before. I'm sorry, it's not more lenient than what had come before. It was stricter than what has gone before. But the point is not just leniency and strictness. It's let's don't take that first step that gets us a long way down the road toward hurting somebody and hurting ourselves, hurting our marriage, and ruining our life. Number 11. Does a man's right hand or right eye operate independently of his mind? Now, I'm sorry for asking such foolish questions because obviously every fool knows that that is true. Now, the answer, though, needs to be brought into focus. What's the point in cutting your hand off if your hand does something, if your hand steals something? What's the point in plucking your eye out if your eye looked upon a woman to lust after her in your heart? Because the fact is, it was your heart that did this thing. It was your mind that did it. Your eye is under the full control of your mind. You can decide where that thing is going to look and where it's not going to look, can't you? Well, now, a man's right eye or right hand does not operate independently of his mind. Number 12, if a man's hand is used to commit a sin, is it the hand's fault? Well, of course not. Number 13, is it likely then that Jesus was speaking literally when he said to cut off the hand or pluck out the eye? Well, obviously he was not. Now, once again, it's okay to read what Jesus has to say and use common sense to understand what he was driving at. Plainly, he was speaking figuratively. And the pattern is clear. Jesus cites the commandment, gives a judgment, teaches about the law. He uses a figure of speech that says, you know, you need to get rid of those things in your life. You need to cut them off. I mean, it's so important that if it's as close to you as your right hand, cut it off. You need to cut off those things in your life. Stop those things in your life that lead you to commit this kind of sin. Because unless you stop these things at the first step, you will find it almost impossible to stop them at a later time. You don't allow anger to fester in your heart against your brother. You don't look upon a woman to lust after her in your heart, and you cut off those things around you that cause you to offend in order to keep yourself from taking the first step down the road to sin. It's not really that hard to understand. You got a subscription to Playboy magazine? Cancel it. Cut it off. Throw it in the trash. Don't allow those things to hang around, because they will affect your mind, and they do involve, in many cases, the first step down the line toward the committing of sin. Watch yourself. Question number 14. Did Jesus forbid divorce for any reason? Yes, indeed he did. This particular subject of divorce and remarriage is a complicated one, and it has to be studied over a broader area than what I can cover on this particular tape. We have literature on the subject. Feel free to write to us for the information that develops the subject of divorce and remarriage more thoroughly. But yes, indeed, Jesus did forbid divorce for some reasons. He gave a specific illustration of a case in which a woman might be divorced and remarry, but otherwise they are supposed to stay married all the way to the end. Was Jesus' judgment on divorce more or less lenient than what had gone before, verse 15? Well, it was more strict. It was less lenient than what had gone before. For the Pharisees basically followed what Moses said back in the Old Testament, just write her a writing of divorcement and put her away. They were very lenient in the permission of divorce. Question number 16. Who was it that rendered the older judgment about swearing? Actually, you don't really find these words anywhere in the Bible. The closest thing, I guess, you get to it is somewhere back in Leviticus 19:12, but it really doesn't come straight out of the law. Presumably, then, this is a matter out of the oral law that had been carried down by the Jews to this point. Question number 17, how did Jesus' judgment differ from theirs? Well, basically, it was that in your life, it really should be good enough for you to say yes and no. It shouldn't be necessary for you to go swearing about this, that, and the other thing, or by the hair of my chinny chin chin, or by your eyes, or anything else. Your word should be good. That was Jesus' judgment on this matter. Number 18, what was Jesus' judgment relative to Leviticus 24:19-20? And be sure and carefully compare Leviticus 19 and verse 18. Jesus' judgment relative to the old eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth law was that one should not exact personal vengeance. That is, one should not go back and try to take an eye when one has cost an eye at a personal level. Now, this does not mean that there should not be a civil authority that exacts penalties for crimes. What Jesus is talking about here is that you as a person, when you have been harmed by someone, you should not be pursuing them in a vengeful way. The law presumed a legitimate authority which would exact vengeance in the Old Testament and in the New. There should be a legitimate authority that will exact vengeance, that will see to it that a man is paid for any damage he has caused to another man. Jesus' teaching concerning this law emphasized the principle of Leviticus 19:18 in that he forbade the pursuit of personal vengeance. Number 19, if a villainous person knocks you down and threatens to do you grievous bodily harm, must you just get up and let him break your jaw? No. Number 20, in such a case, is it permissible to run away? Certainly. It'd make a whole lot of sense to get away from the man. We've already seen that Jesus uses figures of speech to make his point. In other words, he told you, if your right hand offends you, cut it off. He didn't expect you to take that literally. He expected you to understand from it that those things that are around you that cause offense, you should get out of your life. And what he's talking about in this particular case and driving at in the context is that we are simply not allowed to try to exact personal vengeance. It should be left to civil authorities. And he uses the turn the other cheek in that sense, that if a man knocks you down, you do not pursue him to pursue vengeance upon him. The point simply being that does not mean you can't get away from him, that you shouldn't flee from him. But if you are attacked, you must not avenge yourself. You should leave that to the authorities. Now we'll shift our attention to Mark the 7th chapter. Question number 21 asks, is the conflict here over the law of God or over the tradition of the elders? Plainly, it is a matter of tradition. The Pharisees and their tradition, unless they washed regularly, did not eat. They had to hold on to the tradition of the elders. Question number 22, does Jesus place the tradition of the elders on a par with the commandments of God? Plainly, he does not. One of the points he makes in this passage is that they were placing their traditions above the commandments of God. They should not be even on a par with the commandments of God. The commandments of God transcend in all cases. Number 23. Does Jesus see the traditions as a correct interpretation of the law of God? No, plainly he does not. Number 24. Which of the traditions did Jesus' disciples break to raise this question? Which of the traditions did Jesus' disciples break to raise this question? Well, they were out there eating their food without washing their hands. Question number 24 then is, they ate without washing. Number 25, what other phrase does Jesus use as a parallel to the traditions of the elders? If you pass on down to verse 7, howbeit in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. Actually, they placed their own commandments, or the commandments of men, the oral tradition, on a par with, or in some ways ahead of, the law of God. And Jesus said, for laying aside the commandment of God, you hold the tradition of men, such as the washing of pots and cups and many other such like things you do. And he said unto them, full well you reject the commandment of God, that you may keep your own tradition. Number 26. Which of the Ten Commandments did Jesus use to illustrate the Pharisees were rejecting the law of God in favor of the commandments of men? The illustration comes from the fifth commandment, thou shalt honor your father and your mother. But Jesus uses a judgment from the law of Moses, specifically Exodus 21:17. The word Corban, which Jesus uses here, has to do with money offered to the treasury of the temple. According to Jesus, this is question number 27, what was the net effect of the Pharisees' judgment relative to this commandment? Jesus said they made the word of God of no effect through their tradition, that their judgments that they rendered relative to the law formed a part of their tradition, which actually rendered the law of God of no effect. A person no longer needed to honor his father and his mother. If he gave this particular contribution to God, he had to give no money to his mother and father. Number 28. Is it possible through traditions or commandments of men to render vain the worship of God? Yes. Number 29. Did Jesus accept the Pharisees' judgment in this area? No. Number 30. Again, what was the provocation that started this entire line of teaching from Jesus? It was the challenge from the Pharisees and the scribes who asked Jesus, verse 5, why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders but eat with unwashed hands? That was the provocation. Number 31, is there any mention of either law or tradition having to do with dietary laws in this section? Answer, no, none whatsoever. Number 32, Jesus' teaching or his judgment had to do with which of the traditions of the elders? That of washing or not washing their hands. Number 33, did his disciples felt they understood what he was saying? Verse 17 suggests that they did not understand what he was saying, that they had somehow listened and heard, but they considered what he had just said a parable. The reason this is of interest is verse 15. Jesus has said, hearken to me, every one of you, and understand that there is nothing from without a man that entering into him can defile him, but the things that come out of him, these are the things that defile the man. Now, this has often been used by many people to say that Jesus did away with the laws having to do with clean and unclean meats, and that he is saying by this that it's okay to eat pork and shrimp and all these other odds and ends. That's why we specify here that the controversy had nothing to do with dietary laws, or for that matter with the law of God. It had solely to do with the tradition of the elders. So let's look carefully at what Jesus said. Question number 34, is Jesus saying that there is nothing that a man can eat that will harm him? Well, you might carelessly think that that was the case if you just look at this and didn't think about it. But Jesus didn't say harm, he said defile. And he's talking about a ceremonial type of defilement, because that's what the Pharisees were all concerned about in the scrubbing of their hands up to their elbows and all of the washings that they went through. Yeah, by that time, everybody knew you didn't have to wash your hands every time you eat to keep from getting sick. It was a ceremonial. It was a religious thing that they were supposed to do. So Jesus isn't saying that there's nothing that a man can eat that will harm him. Number 35, can you conclude from this passage that arsenic, entering in from without a man, will not kill him? Well, that would be absurd, wouldn't it? The answer is no, you can't conclude that. Number 36, when Jesus said that nothing a man takes in through his mouth can defile him, is the defilement in question physical harm or moral harm? Oh, well, that's easy enough. It can't be physical harm. It pretty well has to be moral harm or some sort of spiritual thing. 37, where does the dirt on food end up? Well, basically, it just goes through the body and goes out, as Jesus said, into the draft, and it's just purged from the body. It says nothing whatever about making food clean. That was not in this particular thing at all. Number 38, is Jesus talking about moral or physical defilement? Again, he's talking about moral defilement, not a matter of anything else. This passage once again illustrates the practice of rendering judgments about the law, teaching from the law, and the development of traditions about the law. Now we pass on to Matthew 12, verses 1 through 9. Question number 30. Was it lawful for the disciples to pick grain passing through a stranger's field? The reference to Deuteronomy 23 will show you that the law actually specifically permitted you, if you were passing through a vineyard, a field, that you could take food and eat just what was sufficient for you on the spot. You couldn't fill your pockets or a basket with it and take it home, but you could eat that when you were going through and not be considered stealing at all. Number 40, what was the Pharisees' judgment relative to doing this on the Sabbath day? Well, their judgment was that that was wrong, that you're not allowed to do that. Number 41, did Jesus agree with that judgment? Plainly, no, he did not. Now, in analyzing the section here, it's obvious that there's no objection to eating on the Sabbath, nor with picking up a morsel of food and taking it to the mouth. The objection seems to be that the disciples were harvesting the grain on the Sabbath. The Pharisees would conclude, if you can pluck one ear of grain, then why not two? And if two, why not three? And they would have said, where do you draw the line? And in fact, their religion was pretty much involved with line drawing. You know, you have to specify the time of sundown. You have to specify how much weight a person can carry on the Sabbath day. Everything was the drawing of lines and the determining of specific things that you could and could not do at the law. And common sense? Oh, forget about common sense. It was right out the window. The difference between harvesting and feeding yourself seems simple enough to me. It's a matter of what I intended when I walked up there and grabbed the grain in the first place. But if you can't discern the intent, well, then basically, actually, all you've got's numbers, and the Pharisees had to draw their numbers. Now, what Jesus does at this point is interesting. He does not argue the right or wrong of the action, but argues the right of individual and personal judgment. Not only that, he argues that there are exceptions to the law, something that Pharisees no doubt found downright unnerving. What is the primary example, number 42, what is the primary example Jesus offers to refute the Pharisees' charge? The example, of course, was the example of David and his men, who, when they were out, had no food. They came to the tabernacle, and the only bread that was anywhere around to be eaten was the showbread. And they had to use a little common sense and to make a decision as to whether it was right or wrong for them to eat that on that particular occasion. Basically, it was the right of individual and personal judgment of the people concerned. They figured out a way whereby they could do it. Number 43, was it lawful for David and his men to eat the showbread? No, in fact, it wasn't. Number 44, what scriptural authority did David cite to justify eating the holy bread? Well, if you read the passage in 1 Samuel 21, you will see he didn't cite any scriptural authority at all. He basically just answered the priest's questions and rationalized the question and went ahead and took the bread and ate it. How did they come to the conclusion, number 46, that it was permissible to eat? By rationalization. They reasoned their way to it. Number 47, did Jesus concur with their decision? Yes, he did. They cited no scriptural authority. They sat down and they reasoned and said, well, now the young men have been kept from women and the vessels are holy, and they had their little discussion, and they came to a conclusion that they could go ahead under this circumstance, on this occasion, and eat it. And Jesus said, yeah, they made the right decision. Note that David and his men reasoned that the case was an exception. They rationalized it by observing that the young men were not defiled and the bread was not entirely holy, and they figured that the thing met in the middle. Yet, Jesus still says it wasn't lawful, and yet he says they made the right decision. Number 48. Did the decision of David and the priest in any way change the law Or was it a simple one-time exception? Isn't that easy? It was just a simple one-time exception. It didn't change the law. Number 49. What if they were wrong? Who was responsible for the consequences of a wrong judgment? Well, the men who made it. That's easy, isn't it? Number 50. Were the Pharisees in any way responsible for the consequences of a wrong decision by Jesus' disciples? No. It didn't affect them at all. It had absolutely nothing to do with them. It didn't change their Sabbath day. It didn't change the way they did things. It had nothing. They were in no way responsible for it. Number 51. In what way might the temple priest have profaned the Sabbath? What duties did they have that might have conflicted? Now, if you check the scripture reference given, you'll know the priests were required to offer more animals in sacrifice on the Sabbath than they did on a regular weekday. So, consequently, they had to actually take the animals up there, kill them, cut them up, lay out the animals on the altar, sprinkle the blood, and by anybody's reckoning, that's a lot of work. So, they killed animals on the Sabbath. Number 52, was the slaughter, cutting, and burning of animal sacrifices work? Hard work. Yes. Did it profane the Sabbath? According to Jesus, it did. Now, I call your attention to the fact that Jesus' first example was of a reasoned exception to the law based on human need. The second example involves something rather different. It's a conflict between two laws, the one requiring that no work be done, the other requiring that sacrifices would be done. In offering this example, Jesus acknowledges that the law of God can sometimes come in conflict and that a judgment may be required as to which law takes precedence. It's an old question based upon one or the other of two choices, to do the lesser of two evils or to do the greater of two goods. Now, this runs counter to what most of us would intuitively think was true about the law. We would think that the law was all set up in a perfect way so that two laws could never come into conflict. Wrong. They can, and they did, and Jesus said so and told us how it worked. Number 53, in this example, which law took precedence? Well, the sacrificial law took precedence. Now, why might that have been? I ask you in question 54 to write a paragraph giving your judgment of why it would take precedence. Normally, one would expect the greater of two laws to take precedence. In other words, the Sabbath, the Ten Commandments, are the underlying, the most powerful law, and anything that came into conflict with one of the Ten Commandments would have to be set aside in favor of the commandment. And yet on this particular occasion, the fourth commandment, which says you're not to do any work on the Sabbath day, is set aside in favor of a mere ceremony. The problem is those ceremonies were not just mere ceremonies. They were what really the plan of redemption of God was all about. The temple was a stage upon which the gospel was played out. Each of those sacrifices actually, in a way, pictured Christ and pictured a part of his work, a pictured his ministry. They had to do with his sacrifice. And so in the process of doing this, they were playing out on the stage in the temple the plan of redemption. They were doing the work of God. They were, in a sense, preaching the gospel. And that's why it took precedence over the Ten Commandments. Number 55. Did Jesus consider that his disciples had done anything wrong? No. He says they are absolutely guiltless and innocent. Number 56. Had the Pharisees been merciful in their judgment of the disciples? Well, hardly. They had been perhaps fair. They had might have been considered consistent. But, you know, fairness and consistency are virtues, but mercy is a greater virtue than any of them. And that was the thing that Jesus chastised the Pharisees for in this particular case. Christ argues not for the abolition of the law, but for a merciful application of the law, a considerate application, a common sense application, an awareness of human beings and human needs and the way these things work. The law is made for man and not man for the law. Number 57, what was the judgment of the Pharisees relative to healing on the Sabbath day? Well, astonishingly, it was wrong. What was their judgment, number 58, regarding work done to rescue a trapped animal? Well, their judgment is that that work could be done. It's really astonishing to see how on earth they could have come to those two conclusions. Number 59, did Jesus agree with their judgment? Well, yeah, he agreed that the work to be done to rescue a trapped animal was okay.
but he did not agree with them relative to healing on the Sabbath day. Number 60, did Jesus see healing on the Sabbath as an exception to the law or as a lawful act? Verse 12, it is lawful to do well on the Sabbath day. His judgment was that healing was a lawful act. He would have considered the work done to rescue a trapped animal, on the other hand, as an exception to the law. What was the Pharisees' response to the miracle? Check verse 14. They went out and held a council against him how they might destroy him. This to me is one of the most astonishing verses in this whole gospel account. Number 62. If there is a day which is the, quote, Lord's day, end quote, which day is it? Well, verse 8 answers that question. The Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. So the day that belongs to him is not Sunday, it's the Sabbath day. Now we turn to Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4. Number 63. Under the judgments given to Moses, was it permissible to divorce with the right of remarriage? Yes, it was. Very plainly, it was possible. Number 64. Was it permissible under all circumstances? Well, no. There's not a suggestion in here at all that says he could divorce her because he found another woman. There's nothing in here that says he could divorce her because she turned out to be a bad cook. He was able to divorce her because of some matter of nakedness or sexual uncleanness. Number 65, if divorced for this reason, could a woman remarry? Yes, she could. Number 66, if divorced a second time, could she return to the first husband? No. Number 67, in what way might this sort of error, quote, cause the land to sin, end quote? Well, the answer to that is a little difficult, perhaps, but what it's talking about is that if you have people running around from bed to bed to bed to bed, a woman goes on, leaves this man and marries that man, and then goes back to the first man, then leaves him again and goes to another man, what's the point in marriage at all? What you wind up doing is destroying the family. And when it talks about causing the land to sin, it basically, using the word land in the sense of the nation, the place where we live, our country, our beloved country, would fall into sin, and that society would begin to come apart. Number 68, were people always stoned to death for committing sexual uncleanness? No, they were not. The intent to carry out this had to generally be done by the person who was offended. There had to be an accuser. There had to be someone who wanted to carry it out. And you'll notice in Joseph's case where he assumed that something had happened with Mary, he decided he did not intend to do that at all. He was going to put her away privately and not make a major issue out of it. The wording of the passage suggests that it's a judgment. It's an application of law to a life situation. It says that when the situation prevails, this is what you should do. It is a response to sin. A man has found sin in his wife. In a perfect world, a judgment like this would not be necessary, but men and women sin. They aren't perfect, and this is not a perfect world. Their sins pose a problem for a society or a community. How do we live with the consequences of sin? We're going to kill all the sinners? Well, they won't leave many of us left. Besides, the death penalty required an accuser and a willing executioner. Someone had to cast the first stone. Even in the Old Testament, it was permissible to extend mercy to a sinner. But when we've done it, what do we do with society? This particular little passage of Scripture shows us that judgments were rendered as to what to do with life after sin has made a mess of it. Sin has consequences, and a community must live with those consequences and deal with them. In order to formalize the separation and subsequent remarriage, a writ of divorcement was required. The judgment is an attempt to stabilize society. The reference to causing the land to sin uses the word land in the sense of nation, as I've already explained. Unless some control of divorce and remarriage is exerted, you may have an entire nation of people running around from bed to bed and back again. Now, here comes the important question. How did Jesus view and look upon the judgment that was given by Moses in Deuteronomy 24? He was specifically asked about it in Matthew 19. We'll read verses 3 through 12. Number 69, what exactly was the scope of the Pharisees' inquiry? Well, they wanted to know if a man could put away his wife for every cause. If she burns a meal, or one meal too many, or if she doesn't take care of the kids properly, can he throw her out? Number 70, what was Jesus' judgment about divorce for every cause? His answer is that God, from the beginning, made man male and female and had an intent for them. From the beginning, he said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother, cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Wherefore they are no more two, but one, and whatever God has joined together, man should not put asunder. Basically, what Jesus' answer boils down to is one man, one woman, for life. Number 71, did Jesus cite Scripture for his authority? He surely did. He laid it right squarely back at creation. However, he does not cite the judgment of Moses, but the law as expressed in its original intent. He went back to the creation of account for his authority and what God really meant to happen. But the Pharisees weren't satisfied with this. They pressed on because they said, okay, fine, you've told us what God said from the beginning. What we want to know then is, why did Moses then say we could write a bill of divorcement? Number 72. Did Jesus draw a distinction between Moses' judgment and the original intent of God when he made man and woman? Yes, he did. After they have asked him this question, why then did Moses do that? He said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you to put away your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. There was a distinction between the judgment rendered by Moses and the original intent of the law of God. Number 73. What did he offer as the reason why Moses allowed the exception to the original sin, or to the original law? The hardness of your hearts. In other words, because you are sinners, and because you will break the law, and because of the hardness of your heart, this judgment had to be given to you so that life could go on in spite of the sins that he knew that you would be committing along the way. Number 74. Did Jesus allow the same exception as Moses in the case of sin? Now, this provides a very interesting contrast in this passage. He closes this out by saying this, I say unto you, whoever will put away his wife, except it be for fornication, the Greek word is porneia, and means sexual uncleanness, and shall marry another commits adultery, and whoever marries her which is put away commits adultery. He started out by saying it's one man, one woman for life with no exceptions. Then when he was asked about Moses' judgment, he confirmed the reasons behind Moses' judgment and said that in real life, because of human sin, then this judgment will still apply, and that Jesus' judgment on divorce with the right of remarriage is actually the same as the judgment of Moses rendered in Deuteronomy 24. Number 75, did Jesus allow divorce with the right of remarriage for sexual sins? Yes, he did. Number 76, did Jesus allow divorce with the right of remarriage for anything other than sexual sins? No, he didn't. Number 77, did Jesus say anything to negate the law of Moses relative to divorce and remarriage? No, he didn't. Number 78, the disciples drew a conclusion from Jesus' teaching in this area. Does their conclusion seem logical to follow? Well, I don't know about you, but it did not seem logical to me, at least on the surface of it. Number 79, does Jesus acknowledge that men and women have needs that may require marriage? Yes, he does. That human beings are sexual creatures, they have needs, and in the interest of not having them copulate freely over the landscape so that in fact that they actually have a stable society and they are able to have families and for the sake of the children, then these judgments are given by Jesus and by Moses to try to keep society something like on the right track. Jesus acknowledges that men and women have needs that may require marriages. Matthew 23, verses 1 through 4. Number 80. Who, according to Jesus, was currently occupying the seats of judgment derived from Moses' authority? Well, the Pharisees, plainly. Number 81. In what category of law might they have been binding heavy and grievous burdens? In what category of law might they have been binding heavy and grievous burdens? Now, you probably had trouble with that question, and I might not have worded it as well as I might. But basically, number 82 kind of gives you the clue to it. Did they have the authority to bind or loose the written law? No, they did not. So the only category of law in which they could have been binding heavy and grievous burdens was in the oral law, and that was the correct answer to that question. I'm sorry if I didn't give you a better shot at it than that. Matthew 11, verses 25 and 30. What scope of authority has the Father placed in the hands of Jesus? Well, total authority. All power, all authority was given to him in heaven and earth. Number 84. Considered as a yoke or burden, how did Jesus' judgments relative to the law compare with that of the Pharisees? Ah, my burden is easy, and it's light. My yoke is easy, my burden is light. There's not much question that the burden that Jesus places upon us is a light one indeed. The law is given to teach us how to live, and Christ gives us enormous latitude in arriving at personal and individual judgments about how we're going to keep that law, and he's going to judge us with mercy relative to that law. He's not standing around waiting for us to make some technical mistake in the law so that he can write it up on a board against us and hold us accountable for it throughout all eternity. The law is given to make men's burdens lighter, not heavier. Self-righteous men saw the law as a means of control and imposed frustrating rules and regulations. They saw it as their duty to see that no one broke it. That's what imposed a yoke of bondage, and not the law itself. But it is sin that imposes the heaviest burden of all. Compared to that yoke, Jesus' burden is light indeed. We'll be with you again in the next lesson.